Welcome to another episode of The Gateway. My name is Russ, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts Amin and Biagio. For this episode, The Gateway is excited to welcome Dr. Carl Swanson. Carl brings over 10 years of combined experience in data science and informatics at the intersection of the clinical and biomedical domains. Carl's passionate about developing innovative applications using artificial intelligence for clinical use cases. Carl holds a DO in osteopathic medicine, an MS in computational biology, and a BS in biology. Carl has completed a residency in internal medicine and started a fellowship and combined research postdoc in clinical informatics at UCSF, but left to found a company towards the same aim. Carl, thank you so much for joining us today. We are excited to have you.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be here. It's great to meet y'all.
Yeah. This is, I love how the world works these days. We can connect with people from all around the world, all around the country, and learn something. And that's where I'm coming from. But I always like to start these episodes from the beginning. So how did you get to where you are?
Yeah. Happy to talk about that. This is it's about a 15-year path. So, time estimate, like 10 minutes max, 5 minutes or yeah,
really whatever. We, a lot of times we'll just take that and go from there. And seriously, yeah. you do you.
Don't okay. worry. We are not shy about interrupting, honestly.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Then I'll just, I'll start my ramble. I have like a pre-canned speech that I used to give to investors and stuff, but this is not that. So, So I started in undergrad. I was a confused undergrad, to be honest. I was much more focused on like my hobbies. I still like did well enough in school, but yeah, I thought I was going to be a mixed martial arts fighter or a punk rock guitarist. I went on like a couple national tours.
Whoa. A couple of national tours for real? I was just going to be like, great idea. That sounds
Let's
awesome.
Talk about that.
Like, you actually did it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I played like Warped Tour, I think, before I could drive, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. Yeah. That was around 2008. Yep. So
what can you, or do you not like want to disclose that? Okay.
No, I don't mind. We weren't like big. We were like a pop punk band. And we were called Eyes on the Prize. We were like, locally. And I think maybe a few people in each state would like show up and know who we were. But, yeah, so that was fun.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. And then, I got really into martial arts. I like grew up doing various martial arts, like Taekwondo, and I wrestled. And so I was, what am I going to do to keep active while studying? And so I got into jiu-jitsu, which led to Muay Thai. And so I did about 4 fights and then a bunch of jiu-jitsu tournaments later, because I started reading about CTE when I was in neurobio, and I was like, I should probably stop getting hit in the head. So that's what I thought I was going to do, like, honestly. And I realized I needed a job at the end of college. I wrote my senior thesis. I was like trying to model tumor genesis, borrowed a lot of the math from something called the Michaelis-Menten equations, which is like rate kinematics for how you would like saturate an enzyme. And I basically was postulating that like this can kind of happen from like single nucleotide polymorphisms or like bigger events. You have to hit like this saturation point. Which isn't exactly true if you think about things like nuts and two-hit hypothesis. But anyways, that paper was enough to like get the attention of the chair of the biology department. He was the one that like led the senior thesis thing. And he's like, hey, what are you doing after graduation? I was like, I don't know. I think I'm going to like try to play music. And he's like, you should come to grad school here. And so I was like, okay, I'll do that. Paid. I didn't know that like grad school was funded. And I was like, oh, this is sweet. So I went to grad school and like immediately fell in love with like computational biology. I took like data structures, algorithms, learned Python. And I was researching specifically non-coding RNA, but like small non-coding RNAs and like how they can help regulate genes. I got kind of sick of like animal models. Because I had wrote that paper on modeling tumorigenesis, I kept asking for human data and specifically cancer data, which was not as available at the time. And so my PI was like, listen, you're going to have to do a bunch of postdocs in translational labs, or you can go to medical school. So on a whim, I was like, okay, I'm going to go to medical school. And so I applied, got into medical school, continued doing like what I would call like data analytics stuff for papers. Kind of got away from the genomic space. This was much more like clinically oriented. And then got like, I thought I was going to do orthopedics for a second, like helped write a paper on that, but fell in love with internal medicine because it's just kind of like a very broad scoped field. And I figured like this would allow me to apply to hematology oncology for fellowship. And from there, I could do like some genomics for like cancer research. I went into like the clinical parts of my medical trainings, so, like the latter half of medical school and starting residency. Realize that, wow, okay, we're using tech from, I mean, literally like the Oregon Trail, right? We still use a fax machine. I think the first fax was sent around that time. And so yeah, I realized like, okay, I have like kind of this technical skill set. And I think it was around like 2014, 2015, a new medical specialty, and I've been around for a while, but was like official that you could do this as a fellowship called clinical informatics, was like coming out. And so I was like, maybe I'll do like just clinical informatics, and this way I can stay more general. I won't be locked into just like cancer genomics, and I think I can have an impact there. So during residency, did that. I actually there's also like a bit of a serendipitous story, but I'm realizing I'm like rambling here. But I'll try to keep this one short. Like some of the research that I wanted to do got put on hold because I was like a COVID intern. It started right at the beginning of my residency, and I was talking to a guy on Reddit. Just about like COVID data. It turned out he was a PI at the Harvard CS lab, and he wanted to make a system that could take patient notes and or yeah, clinical notes and like translate them essentially for like patient-friendly language. And so that was really my first foray into like natural language processing. And I was kind of just doing that because it was like fun. Around the same time, Transformers had come out. And so I was playing with like the early models. I was doing like early Seek-to-Seq stuff. And yeah, from there I was like, okay, I know what I want to do like for research for sure is just like do deep learning stuff for clinician workflows. So went to UCSF for that, started a fellowship in clinical informatics. And I was getting set up to do my postdoc. As everyone knows, like ChatGPT came out in 2022. And so suddenly, I had been saying that like decoder models specifically were going to be like really good for things. And everyone's like, BERT is the way to go, especially for like NLU tasks. Like, what are you talking about? ChatGPT comes out and they're like, oh, wow, these things can actually work. Suddenly people were trying to hire me. And I was very reluctant to leave academia because I had spent like, the past 10 years, I felt like I was finally there. I was like in this great postdoc. And, yeah, this gentleman, I can say his name. His name's Michael Lesh, great guy. He was the guy that invented like the Watchman device, which is a device that helps prevent stroke in atrial fibrillation, and also invented like the catheter ablation technique, plus the actual catheter we use for AFib as well to like ablate the heart tissue to stop it from fibrillating. So he was like a very experienced entrepreneur. He had a background from MIT and sorry, he was an electrical engineer before he went into medicine for electrophysiology. I know this is long, I'm wrapping it up.
No, you're good. I'm loving it.
And so yeah, he's like, hey, come start this company with me. And I trusted him because his previous company, and because he was an EE, he knew his stuff about like deep learning. Previous company was something called Syntegra, which used transformers pretty early on. Again, like I think it was like 2018, they were using these things, plus like GANs and stuff to take clinical data and make it synthetic so that you could do like data privacy sharing things. So anyways, I was like, okay, this guy knows what he's doing. He's a doc. I trust him. I will leave my fellowship and found this company with him. And he's like, said he would angel fund pretty much and I could research whatever I wanted to. That company still exists. But just due to market forces, we pivoted away from building what we call like an inbox, like a clinical inbox manager, because physicians are like overwhelmed sometimes with the amount of patient messages they got. I figured I could use like some transformer and like rag magic to reply to some of these messages. And so that was the initial use case. Again, because of the market forces, we had to pivot to the medical legal space, and that's where the company is. I didn't get into this to do like legal work. So I was like, hey, listen, like I'll finish up the product. But after that, I'm going to like bail, because now there was like a bunch of other AI clinical companies that were like also talking to me. Spent a brief stint at another research AI company called Healthcare Agents. Those guys are great. Definitely look up the founders of those company and like check them out, because I really like their mission. But they were more patient facing, and I figured I could help more again with like the clinician facing stuff. Finally, Ambience reached out to me, and that's where I am now. And that's it. That's 15 years. Yeah. And yeah, whatever amount of time.
Right, Carl. That is absolutely awesome. And I have a lot of questions, like how can I find your music? I will say, as you were speaking about that, I was doing some Googling research, and you are probably one of the, I don't know if you want to say lucky or the more, there's not a lot, like it's not out there where I think most of the people now that have had your experience will not be able to potentially not be found as easily. Like you were in the beginning of, now these people, like my students, man, like their stuff is out there. Like everything about their life for their whole time. And it's just very interesting to see that you've lived multiple lives, and it's not as public as what many bands who have been relatively successful, you know, don't get to be. So all joking aside, I do want to focus on kind of where you're at, because I think the work you're doing is going to be very important. And in a lot of our conversations, we get into talking about using large language models, and specifically healthcare, because I think that is something that a lot of that will changes lives essentially. And if we can use that and make people's lives a little bit better in a very real and very those are difficult times for a lot of people. And if anything you're doing makes it even incrementally better, I love that. So my rambling will stop here and go into more of that process of switching from the caregiving, the clinician being the person there to help someone figure out what's going on, to be the doctor, to more of the researcher and the AI side of that. What was that transition like for you?
Yeah, I get asked this a fair amount. And I think if you plan on doing a physician scientist pathway, which I kind of did in more of a roundabout way, most people do like MD, PhD, or they do a postdoc, like I was in the process of doing, but I had gone to grad school before this. So it was a little backwards. But I think most folks do go into this path with the intention of dialing back clinical practice. At some point, the common, what we call split, like for full-time employment, is you only do like around like 20%, sometimes even less, like 5 to 10% of clinical practice of your full-time employment, and then the rest you just do research. And so, yeah, I first, you know, residency, that switch was definitely, it was interesting, because residency is like 200%, 300% FTE of like clinical care, with like whatever you can fit in for research, you know,
around
afterwards. Yeah. And so, yeah, I will say it was almost, I do miss the bedside here and there. I don't think I've been in like a couple months now to actually practice, but I still, you know, do. I'm probably closer to like 10% now. So yeah, I miss that. I miss making an impact on patients. It's very like on the nose when things are not going well, especially as like a hospitalist in internal medicine. Most people you see are quite sick, and you know, you see them come in sick, sometimes like comatose or something, and with good outcomes, things turn around, people are happy. So you kind of get that like immediate gratification of like, wow, I made a change. But at the same time, I like having the experience being a clinician and just knowing how difficult it is. And for my colleagues, especially, not so much for me anymore, but like I did live that for several years. I feel like I can make like a bigger impact. Not saying that clinicians make less of an impact, but for my set of skills, particularly, like, this is the path for me to like help people. So yeah, I'm happy and I somewhat miss it is, I guess, the short answer.
Yeah, I really enjoy that. And I think you touched on something of finding a skill set, you know, that works for you in a way that you could do it. Because I think a lot of people go through that, their career of like, I'm good in A position, but then B comes along and you're like, wow, I can do something. But I think a lot of careers, you end up getting away from either your clients, your people that you're working with, because you're getting higher up, you're getting better, and you can make a larger impact, but it sometimes comes at the cost of that face-to-face, that person-to-person interaction. Along with that, as you're going from medical and that biological background to the artificial intelligence, which is a representation of a biological entity in some ways. I'm stretching the metaphor a little bit.
Sure.
Do you, the problem solving side of that, when you're trying to diagnose, when you're trying to heal, when you're trying to treat someone, does that transfer over into your coding, for a lack of a better term, or is it completely different? And again, what was that like?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a great question. And I think like the underlying theme, like across everything that I've done, maybe minus like the music and MMA stuff, I guess you could maybe like jiu-jitsu is kind of problem solving. It's very active problem
Holy.
Solving.
Yeah, it's a puzzle.
Yeah. And so I really enjoy like what I would call almost like detective work, right? Like there's a problem at hand. There's information that you need to get to solve that problem. And like, what is the best way to know that you've solved that problem? And insofar to like say, I consider medicine to be like the equivalent of soft Bayesian reasoning, right? Like you have a bunch of priors that you know, you have a bunch of data of like prevalence incidence that you're like, okay, this is more or less likely. And then as data comes in, you're just constantly updating those priors. So yeah, medicine, I think, is a good way to learn how to investigate something. And with AI, especially like more the current technology, and just like because there's nice wrappers on everything, it's less of the grunt work than it was like 5 years ago. It is very much like, okay, why is this model not doing what I want to do? And it's a lot of like investigative work to update the initial hypothesis of, I think it can do this. Why is it not doing this anymore? Or how can I get it to do this?
So you mentioned Bayesian reasoning, but deep learning is not. So
sure,
did you try
sure.
Bayesian reasoning first?
No.
Because I love Bayesian reasoning.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think the only time I've ever used like a Bayesian reasoning model was for something that was like an interrupted time series analysis paper that I wrote. But I am not a causal inference guy. Respect to those people. They're
Oh,
crazy.
Yeah.
They're not crazy.
You are very nice to respect causal people. I was at a conference last week and people were fighting over it still.
Yeah. It's just, you know, different discipline, but super, super interesting. I'll like read about it. I'm like, I got like 20% of that, but like, all right, cool.
I mean, you know this better than anyone, probably. You're in medicine. You can't establish a causal link without a controlled experiment. What are these people talking about? So that's the fight.
Yeah, so. I think like, I forget what ITSA is called, like quasi-causal or something like that.
Yeah, they correct themselves when we criticize them. And then when we turn around, they drop the quasi and just keep saying causal.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
My question for you is, medicine is a very high stake application for deep learning, because and one thing we know about deep learning is that its decision criteria isn't transparent. So how do you balance that? Because you probably have you're a regulated industry too, you're very regulated.
Super.
So you probably have to be transparent about every decision criteria you have. But your model isn't. How do you balance that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think there's a lot of talk about like AGI, are models as smart as doctors? You know, like I know Google released like the AMIE or AMI paper I was actually at the conference when they presented this to a bunch of doctors at Stanford. It like, I felt bad for the engineer. It did not go well. Like, people were up in arms about it.
Of course. What were they thinking?
Yeah. So I am not, and neither I will, like, my company is not of the opinion that, like, yeah, we're replacing doctors. And so we're very much focused on developing tools that require a physician in the loop. And if you have like an XY axis of like, this is more risky and this is like high impact, most people are, I think want to exist in like the corner over here where it's high impact, but less risky. And that is where most companies and my company, I think exist. So most of the things we build are just like, you're talking to the patient, and it will, have some recording of that discussion, and then it will like help you write your notes. It would be very bad for the clinician that is using it, because they assume a lot of risk, just being a doctor in general, right? To not review the notes. So it's, of course, in their best interest.
Of course,
to do that.
Yeah.
So that is, that's kind of how I think of balancing it. I will say, I think that like the models do show, if we're going to like anthropomorphize a little bit, like good reasoning, diagnostic reasoning, like they can come up with treatment plans pretty well. But I would, I think the person that put it best was like a recent podcast that Andre Kaparthy was on, and he said, these models can fail silently. And
that's,
so
a very
you,
good
you
could, description.
Yeah, you can build a very large evaluation sets and still not know that this model for some random disease is spewing out like bad information. I think there's risk mitigation strategies around that, but I wouldn't be comfortable like deploying an unsupervised, not like unsupervised like learning, but like a model
autonomous.
Unsupervised. Yeah, exactly. Autonomous is a better word, thanks. In a clinical space as of yet.
Yeah, I think that's a big problem with the high risk applications. For example, in the self-driving example, it drives fine for most of the time, but you just never know. There's no never guaranteed that it won't run over a cyclist,
Yeah,
it might just do that. So I think that your answer is perfect, that in terms of the balance, I got the answer about the balance. You it gains a lot in productivity and risks very little because of the, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I kind of want to jump in the conversation. I mean, Carl, that's just the intro that you provided us is so much in there, and how you get to where you are. And it's so fascinating to me, because I think we talk about technology, data analytics, and AI very often in our podcast, but I think this is the first one in the medical field. And you also have like the entrepreneurship side of things, and kind of putting yourself at risk by going away from a steady position to a company with someone that you kind of like met and trust because of previous success. I kind of like in your, if you can go back and think about what was the reason why you made that switch, is there any particular aspect of the idea that person had at the time that make you convinced beyond the fact that he was successful in the past? Or like, I'm very curious, because I always had an entrepreneur mindset, but leaving academia to just be an entrepreneur, I think is such a big of a step, because I love my students and I love what I'm doing in terms of research. And I'm just like, I can learn a lot from your answer, I think.
Biagio's looking for a job, Carl. That's kind of what he's got. I'm totally playing.
He's about to get tenured. He's about to get locked in.
He's making a choice right now. Like, do I want tenure? Do I want to go?
We are locking him in.
Yeah. Do not take my advice on this. If it wasn't clear from the beginning, I'm a bit of a risk taker. But I think that's part of it. Like, my personality in general is I like shiny objects. I chase things that I think are shiny, and academics was fun. And to be completely frank, like, we, there's many things. Like, we had a high performance GPU cluster, but I would have to reserve space. I wasn't always able to research like exactly what I wanted. Like they were still very good. Like I'd propose something and be like, yeah, we could probably do that. And so, yeah, there's just like a lot of things that I felt like were blockers to what I wanted to do. And so now I have this gentleman where it's like, yes, certainly. I actually, when I was doing this, I was trying to like figure out how I could Likert score everything and like run an ANOVA of like, you know, see what the best decision is for me. But yeah, anyways, he seemed to know what he was doing. So I was like, okay, I kind of like trust that part. Like, I don't think I will leave and just be jobless within a year. And I think I had enough reason to pursue this because he said like, we're going to build a company and I'll just fund basically like whatever it is you want to research. Of course, I learned the hard way that the market does exist. I was very naive to those things. I'd consulted for a few startups that were like healthcare AI things, but I was never on the business side. It was just like, hey, what do you think about this from like a clinical perspective or from like a data perspective? So yeah, I don't know if that's like a good answer, and definitely don't take my advice if you are.
I'm not trying to leave. I had my stint as an entrepreneur and I realized how hard it is. And yeah. You know, especially with a family and kids, is definitely a risk that is not easy to take, or I'm not considering taking, but it was very fascinating that you actually took it. And actually probably you are super happy that you took that choice, because probably change your life and what you're doing nowadays. Although you, I guess you said you're still, you know, making life better for people. It's just a different way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, and to be frank, like when he first proposes to me, I had pitched the inbox idea, right? Which is, it's kind of hard when you're a researcher to be like, I want to build a product essentially, and then we'll, I guess we'll research the product. So I think I was kind of like always like wishing I could build and do more R&D than necessarily just the R. So yeah.
It's also the other interesting part of me. Part of this conversation is you talked about how these tools are solving problem. And like, for example, in research, in our field, in information system, we do have a specific paradigm, which is like problem solving paradigm, which is design science research, where you actually, you know, prototype and design these tools, these technology tools that should help to solve any problem. So it was very interesting to me to see how other disciplines, they probably don't know about this type of paradigm, but they still adopt it because they, you know, they run into problem and they think about smart ways or efficient ways to kind of solve them. So that's definitely, if you want to still publish something in research, maybe there is a way to go, you know, on the research, back in the research, more in the research side of things.
Biagio still looking for tenure, Carl. So if you want to publish with him.
Yeah, let me know if you want to do a healthcare, if you want to somehow collab, we'll figure something out.
I think
out.
He's looking for data.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, this is a classic ask, which is fine. Like, you have healthcare data? Sure.
You guys make me look so bad today.
Sorry, you are a very kind person. Yeah. I'm not trying to joke like that.
I have a technical question, and feel free to not answer.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see what I remember.
The large language models try to impersonate human. That's the optimization. The optimization is, do I sound like a human? Right?
Yeah.
So that, and there's an old saying, you get what you optimize for. If you optimize for sounding like humans, you will get that. But you are trying to have them suggest notes that are the most helpful. That's not necessarily sounding the most. So you're not optimizing. I'm just asking, are you optimizing for your task specifically, or are you trying to make it work by optimizing sound like it?
Yeah, I think I can somewhat like dance around a good answer here, which is, yes, we do. We focus very, we get very task specific.
Okay.
What we optimize for. Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Certainly true.
So then, Carl, kind of going, I'll move to more of your experiences within this. As you were kind of looking at your life path where you were going there. Has the work output, your day to day from a clinician, from doctoring to entrepreneurship, has that been similar? Like, I basically want to know for our students who are maybe thinking about going into the healthcare field, whether it's nursing, whether it's MD, whatever it is, to debating on, hey, I want to be an entrepreneur. I think within business, people are like, I want to be a CEO so I could sit on the beach all day. Where as a doctor, not many people think that. Like, even when you're about to retire from being a doctor, like, we know as a society, I think there's a general understanding that doctors work a lot. And I don't know if that's always given the credit towards entrepreneurship, or maybe it's like for 2 years and then I sell it for $10 billion and I never have to work again.
Where is that deal?
Can you kind of compare those two things as workload of what that experience has been like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, okay, so I don't think anything will ever be as hard as residency was. And I guess not, yeah, I mean, both difficulty, but like work hours as well. Like, there was times where I'd work for like 30 hours straight, which is just crazy. And I think the next closest thing was probably being a founder. My fellowship and postdoc were, it was still a lot of work, don't get me wrong. But like, I got sleep most nights, which is good. So yeah, fellowship is like third, I guess, after like founder. But that's not true for all fellowships either. Like, if you're not in informatics and you're still like, you know, cardiovascular, you're doing kind of like the same things. So yeah, I only had 3 years of the like really bad hours, thankfully. But yeah, as the founder stuff, there would be, you know, there's a couple sleepless nights here and there. I'd still probably get a couple hours. Work output was very high. You know, I was also working with like a very high output person in general, right? This guy is in his 70s and will ride his bike like 50 miles up the Marin Headlands. You know, he has like one of the highest H indexes I've ever seen in my life. I think he has like 300 or something publications. So yeah, his H index, I just looked it up recently. I think it was like 130, which is high. So anyways, like, it's not, he was great, you know, but it was just very clear that it's like, okay, if he's working, like, I better be working. Like, and you need to, right? You have to move fast. You have to like capture markets. And that's hard and scary, because it's especially if it's not your money, right? Which it wasn't. I was like a, you know, broke young adult coming out of fellowship. I didn't have a lot of money. So this is someone else's money that I'm now responsible for. And this could also generate a lot of money if things go well. So it's not as scary as someone like crashing in the ICU at like 3 a.m., but it is definitely hard work. And my current position, it's, you know, we're Series B, so things are like, definitely relax, but I will still, you know, put in long hours on like several days of the week. So nothing worthwhile doing personally is going to be like a cakewalk. It maybe that is the case for some people, but I would consider them like very lucky. You have to put in some time to make things happen. So
I'm continually amazed by people like yourself, Carl, who have multifaceted talents or aptitudes, because I sometimes think when you talk about talents, it discredits the amount of work that is associated to have talent. For you and all of the different varieties that you've pursued, how do you continue that motivation, that work ethic when things are hard, and when you're maybe going through someone crashing in the ICU, or when you have that overnight for your founder, or even now today when you're like, I just got to solve this problem and I don't know where to go? How do you continue to find that motivation?
Yeah, it's like, I don't want to give a super like typical vanilla answer, but I think if you like are true to yourself, what your interests are, obviously the ICU patient, you have a lot of like extrinsic motivation, right? Like, So that one's right. Not as hard.
They're dying. Yeah.
Scary. Your heart rate's also going pretty fast. But yeah, I just at least for the company that I had helped found was it was just a very interesting problem, and I knew firsthand like how difficult this problem was to deal with, and so I wanted it solved. And so I think like if you want to solve something enough, you will find the motivation to do it. And if you're struggling with motivation, it may be like a time to like do some analysis of like, okay, is this truly what I want to be doing? Do I need to pivot to something else? And I've been lucky enough, I think, in my like, and I'll also say there's some luck involved. No way around that. Like, and I would even consider myself that talented. I just do things that I enjoy doing, and want to fix that, like detective work, like solve this problem. So yeah, I guess pursue your interests is the very plain answer, but it's something I followed my entire life. I guess I'm just wired in a lucky fashion to do that. But yeah, that would be my advice.
Within your experiences and how you're trying to utilize these new technologies and create your own, is there a world or end result within the medical field that when you're looking back and you're retired and have kind of an accounting of all of the things that you've put your motivation towards, is there something that you would like to see as a result? And I'm not saying like that everyone lives infinitely, like I'm meaning like more on a tangible, like this would be a successful life, or even in a shorter term window of like, hey, in the next 3 years, this is what I would like to see as something that we've improved on as an industry within the medical field and country, or even globally or even locally, whatever that looks like.
Yeah. I think like currently I see some success stories, right, where like a physician will note like, oh, I was able to finish all of my work and go home and have dinner with my family. And like that alone, I'm like, okay, cool. Like we've done something meaningful here. And so I guess like improving upon that to not just like, okay, I now have like normal hours, but even during the workday, like I'm not stressed trying to sort through like, you know, what could be the equivalent of like hundreds of pages of patient data. Like, can we like accurately summarize this data so you're not like rushed and worried before each patient visit? So just making like, if I can look back and have some like hard evidence that, you know, for X amount of doctors, and ideally a lot of doctors, I've improved their quality of life and their quality of work, I think that will be enough for me. But I kind of got into NLP, like I said, because I was trying to build this patient-facing clinical note translator thing. And so I think at some point I will try to get back to like a more patient facing thing. I'm big into like patient advocacy. I think I've been a patient myself. Actually just like recently had some things going on, but like things are good. Don't worry about it. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard to navigate the healthcare system, and I'm a physician, right? So if I could like help figure out ways to like get patients answers more quickly, have them understand their charts. I'll shout out, I'm actually meeting with someone from Pictal Health next week. They help like patients understand their medical record in like a more like visual way. Really cool company. Check those guys out. Not to just like keep plugging companies I met.
No, we love it.
Yeah. I met them through the Open Notes Consortium, which they were like initially based, I think, out of MassGen. They like study a lot on like how if patients have access to their data, and in particular, like the notes that clinicians write, like, does this help them? And the answer so far is like overwhelmingly yes. But it like, for some reason, that wasn't obvious, you know, and I don't know if it's like physicians they're writing something that maybe they feel they don't want the patient to see, like, and not for nefarious reasons, but just like, they don't want them to worry about this, right? So it's a delicate subject. But if I can help figure that bit out on like, getting patient information, getting them access to care, so on and so forth, I would be pretty happy about that.
God, if I actually, like, if I can express my personal opinion on this, I will say that's definitely something that is missing. And I will connect that to the fact that nowadays people, like when they receive some bad news or medical news, they immediately go Google and think they can be doctor of themselves and finding cures for themselves and stuff like that. And I see this as being just making it worse. Like I remember my grandmother still thinks that whatever the doctor says is right, and she doesn't care. She just follow along what she says. But nowadays people think, oh, maybe I don't need the vaccine, or maybe this is, you know, a lot of misinformation also available on social media and stuff like that will make a tool like the one that you're thinking about so much more important, because instead of searching on just Google or social media, I will search in a place where somebody that is educated to be an expert in that specific area gives in a more accessible way information that we all can consume. I will be very grateful, because although I'm a doctor, I'm not a medical doctor. So when it comes to those things, I don't understand much, and trying to educate myself, not just on the usual sources where everybody goes to, but having a place like what you are thinking, I think it will be extremely helpful and beneficial to the majority of us, not just very impactful work. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
I agree. And the patients don't need to read at all. If in case like they are just worried, they can just talk to their doctor. And if in case they think that they need more insight, it's there. I think that's a great idea.
Yep.
Talk to a chatbot inside your tool. And so they can communicate and get all the answers that they need. I'm throwing too many ideas.
No. It's great. I love these. Yeah, these are fun things to talk about. And yeah, I think would be impactful. I'll plug one last company, which is, I think I said I'd worked for them for a little bit. Healthcare agents, that's like exactly what they're doing. So check those guys out. Super interesting. I wonder if like Andrew would even come on this podcast. He'd be great. You guys would love talking to him. He's much more technical than I am.
We'll write him down.
Yeah. Please, when we're offline, send me that one, because we'd love to. And we always love friends of friends. Like that's how we've done this whole thing. So nice. Carl, I'm wondering, as Amin had mentioned earlier, you know, healthcare is a highly regulated industry, and technology overall, especially within the newer tech spaces, our AI, our large language models, are not currently regulated in many ways. It's more of the wild, wild west on that side of things. We also have, at least in America, a lot of leadership that might not be as versed in technology. And I always like kind of wondering where you see the balance of that. Like you've mentioned, hey, we want to stay on the low risk, high impact area of using tech within healthcare. But I don't know if we are, quote unquote, forcing that. And you even alluded to that, hey, there could be some things out there that do harm unintentionally or hopefully for not nefarious reasons. But where does that go? And from a patient advocacy side of things, do you see that coming? And maybe even, basically, I'm asking if you want to run for a house or set. No, I'm totally playing. But that's something that I think about it. Like this technology is moving very quickly, and I would say I have a little bit of an understanding about it, and I am ignorant of all of the impacts of that one. And some of the people that are making these legislative decisions don't even have the concepts down. How do we protect patients, utilize this technology without hindering the benefits, without completely shutting it down and just, you know, putting our head in the sand? Is that something that you have to think about, or there's not really a question in there. I just want your thoughts. That's all.
Yeah, no, this is a very important issue. And I've been thinking about this a lot recently. So I'm trying to gather my thoughts here on like where to begin, but, I think you do need to strike a balance of like regulation and safety and the ability to like innovate. You know, I'm not like a diehard like innovation at all costs, like move fast and break things, especially not in the healthcare field. That is like a terrible idea in the healthcare field. You should not break things.
Depending on which company we're talking about, it might not have worked that well for them.
Fair enough. Yeah. So I do believe in regulation. I don't know if I'm smart enough to be the guy to say like these are ex the exact regulations that are that should be implemented, but I do believe that like there should be patient safety measures that are like, you know, I mean, I have this is probably more like predictive analytics types of stories, and if you ever read the book like The Digital Doctor by Bob Wachter, great book, you know, he goes over a few stories of just like things that were intended to do good that wound up doing like pretty bad things. I think like one example that I can remember offhand is there was some like predictive algorithm. I don't even remember what they used. Might have been like a decision tree or something. And basically, like the features boil down to like the race of the patient, which is like not a good thing. And so it was just double booking because it was predicting whether or not these patients would show up. And can we add in another patient, right? Because healthcare systems need to fill their quota. And can we double book patients? Like, are we predicting they won't show up? And will this be a safe double booking? And so it's good, right? I understand healthcare systems, they need to make money, they need to survive. And I understand the incentive to double book. Physicians don't like it when both patients show up, and the patients don't like it, right? So I got the sentiment of doing it, but you know, deploying this, and I think this part is in the book. I don't want to spill like too many of the insider beans on this, but when they asked like the folks who were very smart math folks that are not necessarily clinically trained, like why did you not tell us like that this was like the most contributing feature? They're like, well, you know, this is what it boiled down to. This is what the math shows, you know, like this is the model. Like, and it's just like, okay, like, all right. So I think before you deploy anything, like to bring this back, you need to have very robust testing. Probably do something like a ringed release at maximum, if not like try to run through like simulated synthetic patient data or something like that. There are folks that are smarter than me that like work on this. This is not a company, but I'll plug them. There's the Coalition for Health AI, or CHAI for short, not to be confused with the CHAI out of Berkeley, which is the Center for Human Aligned Artificial Intelligence. There's two, but both of them do very important safety work. There was a recent, sorry, and this is the last thing I've been thinking about. There was a recent bill, that was in the House, I think, for California. And it got shut down. I think like Newsom, I'm not good with like how the politics work. But I think Newsom somehow shut it down. And the bill was like the way it was proposed was it would regulate or it was kind of toothless. So I get it. Companies that spend more than like I think $100 million annually trying to develop models or $10 million in fine-tuning, so pre-training versus fine-tuning costs. They would have to agree essentially that they would do some sort of safety testing. But at the same time, there was nothing like built into this bill that would ensure. It was basically like a promise. Like, do you promise to safety test? And it's just like, yes. And so, like, what does that bill do? Right. So, like, I think to your point, legislators need to be like much more specific in the things that they're trying to legislate. And just like in general, be more knowledgeable about the space. And I think they're trying to, right? They like talk to folks. I know a couple of the folks from like healthcare agents that are like bigger people in the AI alignment scene. Like the guy who sat next to me was one of the first dudes to work on RLHF. Great guy, like early OpenAI employee. So those folks are like going and talking to people in Congress, but yeah, we need more of it. I guess is my shorts rambly summary here. Sorry.
No, that was good. I didn't really set you up for much success when I was just rambling and asking for that one. But I think those are things that we're all looking at because it's either AI is going to take over and launch Skynet and we're all going to be surrounded by Terminators, or AI is going to fix absolutely everything and there's absolutely no potential issues with it in whatever possible way, and we're going to be, you know, again, Wall-E sitting in chairs on a spaceship, which is still kind of a dystopia. Never mind. Okay. I'm very grateful for your time, Carl. I want to end with a very, I think, a simple conversation or question, because there's not really a right answer, but for anyone that is thinking about getting into AI and healthcare, or pursuing what I would define as challenging but important pursuits for their life's work, what skills, what advice do you get or want to give for them just in general?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a variety of ways that you can contribute. So I think first figuring out, like, do you want to be technical? Do you want to be more of like a manager of things? Do you like the creative side, like designing things? Because all these are very important parts of how to build something that will be meaningful, right? It's like just as important that your code or the model works as intended as is like the way the human will interact with it. So there's a lot of paths. If you specifically want to do healthcare AI, I'm not suggesting at all that you need to go through the same path I did, which was very long and arduous. I think just simply doing like a PhD in like a comp bio or bioinformatics. There's even like a computational healthcare, I think, PhD now out of like UCSF. You could do that, come out and like go into industry in the Bay and start working. But yeah, biggest piece of advice is just find, you know, just to, I guess, kind of tie it back, like find what interests you in the field and just work like relentlessly towards that goal, and you will get there.
That is a beautiful way to end this conversation. I am very grateful for your time and sharing your wisdom and knowledge with us and our listeners. Thank you so much for being here, Carl.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by Northern Illinois University, where your future is our focus. And please, remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.